Hello, everyone. This is the English 210 podcast. This is episode 5, and I'm Jessica Reed. And this is a description exercise that we're going to do. I'm going to share with you some excerpts from Charles Frazier's novel called 13 Moons. It came out in 2006. These excerpts are exemplary in terms of description and fiction. You're going to hear the richness, and it's just beautiful writing. This particular character is very old, and he's writing towards the beginning of the 20th century. So he finds all of this technology of the early 20th century really bewildering. In this type of situation, you know, the author gets a chance to describe something as if she's never seen it before, as if she's not intimately familiar with its function and the presence in her everyday life. So this is a great exercise whether you're inclined to be a very lavish writer or a minimalist writer. This is really related to a popular exercise that asks creative writing students to imagine describing something on Earth, say a basketball game, the way a Martian would. By putting yourself in the mind of a Martian, everything's going to be strange and alien. So remember, this is very much like what we began with in poetry. The purpose of the exercise is the same: to make the familiar seem unfamiliar, and to make the features we take for granted salient, to bring them to the surface and make them obvious, and even make them seem strange. Remember Charles Simic's poem, The Fork. This kind of awakening of the senses, it's a vital part of writing. So I'm going to play a few excerpts, and at the beginning of each one, I'll point out what object it is that he's describing. It'll become obvious as you listen, but I want you to listen for the way that he describes it.
Random House Audio presents 13 Moons by Charles Frazier. Read for you by Will Patton.
Okay, so this first one is very brief. It's just the description of a light bulb.
The night has become electrified. Mid-evening, May comes to my room. The turn of doorknob, click of bolt and hasp. The opening door casts a wedge of yellow hall light against the wall. Her slender dark hand twists the switch and closes the door. Not a word spoken. The brutal light is message enough. A clear glass bulb hangs in the center of the room from a cord of brown woven cloth. New wires run down the wall in an ugly metal conduit. The bare bulb's little blazing filament burns an angry cloverleaf shape onto my eyeballs that will last until dawn. I see they get up and shut off the electricity and light a candle to read by, or else be blinded. I get up and turn off the light.
Now, in this section, he's going to describe both the record player, phonograph, and the very beginning of moving pictures.
At May's urging, I recently agreed to buy an Edison music machine, the Fireside model. It costs an unimaginable $22. She tells me the way it works is that singers up north holler songs into an enormous metal cone, whereupon their voices are scarified in a thin gyre on a wax cylinder the size of a bean can. I imagine the singers looking as if they were being swallowed by a bear. After digestion, they come out of my corresponding little cone sounding tiny and earnest and far, far away. May is relentlessly modern, which makes me wonder why she takes care of me, for I am resolutely antique. Her enthusiasm for the movies is beyond measure, though the nearest Nickelodeon is half a day's train ride away. Sometimes I give her a few dollars for the train ticket and the movie ticket, with some money left over for dinner along the way. She comes back all excited and full of talk about the thrill of the compact narratives, the inhuman beauty of certain actresses and actors, the magnitude of the images. I have never witnessed a movie other than once in Charleston when I dropped a nickel into the side of a kinetoscope viewer and wound the crank until the bell rang and put the sound tubes like a stethoscope to my ears and then bent to the eyepieces. All I perceived were senseless blurs moving tiny across my mind. I could not adjust my eyes to the pictures. Something looked a little like a man, but he seemed to have a dozen arms and legs and seemed not to occupy any specific world at all, but just a gray fog broken by looming vague shapes. For all I could determine of his surroundings, the man might have been playing baseball or plowing a cornfield or maybe boxing in a ring. I lost interest in the movies at that point. But I understand that a movie has been made about my earlier life and may describe it to me in enthusiastic detail after it played in the nearest town. The title of it is The White Chief. I didn't care to see it. Who wants every bit of life you've ever known boiled down to a few short minutes? I don't need prompting. Memories from those way back times flash up with great particularity. Even individual trees, dead since long before the war, remain standing in my mind, with every leaf etched distinct down to the pale, palmate veins, their whole beings meaningful and bright with color. So why choose to enter that distressing gray cinema fog only to find some lost, unrecognizable phantom of yourself moving through a vague and uncertain world?
All right, now he's going to describe a telephone. You know, it occurs to me that one of the things that makes this book remarkable as well is that these inventions have been modified since this time. So this stuff is unfamiliar to us as well. The telephone, the light bulb, the record player, those are all very, very different from the way they were in the early days. So this makes it interesting from that point of view as well.
Having a telephone installed was Mary's idea. My argument was simple. What does a telephone mean to me? When a few survivors among my acquaintances wish to communicate, they use the post. They said, "Do you even know how telephones work?" Of course I know. You listen and talk, and the discourse passes instantly across vast distances. Along that ugly mess of wires drooping from the crucifixes that have erupted along every roadway as suddenly as toadstools after rain. I asked May why we needed a telephone, and she said, "What if you keeled over with a heart attack or a stroke?" I said, "I reckon in that case I might die." May said she didn't want to have to run to the doctor to make sure I was gone. It would be easier just to call. Shortly afterward, a man came and ran more ugly wires through the house. The telephone rested silent on the wall for days. Then one afternoon, when I was sitting on the porch reading, it rang. So urgent, like a watchman sounding a fire alarm, but surely false in the shrill report of the tiny hammer beating frantically against the two acorn-shaped bells. What message short of disaster could be so pressing as to require that horrible jangle? Use the post and learn the virtues of patience and silence. I waited for someone else to deal with it, but no one did. It kept shrilling. I closed my book and went down the hall to the oak box. It looked somewhat like a coffee grinder. I turned the crank and put the cold circumference of the black earpiece to my head. I heard a tiny voice, more like the scraping of crickets than human speech. The same sound, repeated over and over, and all I could tell was that its inflection seemed to suggest a question.
Okay, now this final clip just amazes me. It's about a map, and of course the character has seen maps before, although actually not many, but it's in the Old West, and there is a lot of Indian territory, there's a lot of land that just hasn't been claimed yet, and or claimed, I should stress, by white men, which is a lot of what this story is about. I highly recommend the novel. It's very long, but it's very interesting. So this is fascinating.
This boy I'm speaking of was a version of me, an early incomplete draft. I still have some of his teeth, and we share an inch-long scar, a deep cut from a horseshoe nail, just below our right ankle bones. The trail ahead forked at a big poplar tree, offering simple choices, left or right. It was a simple time. But I knew even then that you could not just set out in one direction and necessarily get somewhere. You lived in the mountains as if cupped in a puzzle of unclimbable blue ridges and uncrossable black gorges. To travel through that place, you needed to know not only where you wanted to go, but also that roundabout was often the only way to get there. I pondered the choices. Each journey has two possible motions, two directions, toward life, toward death. It was like that for me, or at least it seemed so then. I dropped the reins. The colt I had recently named Waverly in tribute to my favorite Walter Scott novel reached an unsupervised halt, hoofs sucking into the mud. Rhododendron grew close on either side of the trail, and the wet glossed leaves nearly met overhead. When I looked up, water from my hat brim ran down the back of my neck and onto the oversized wool coat my uncle had handed down to me. I pulled a map from my coat pocket and spread it open and rested it across Waverly's withers and studied the markings closely. Raindrops fell on the map, and I bent over to shelter the paper. My forefinger traced the way I thought I had traveled and stopped at the place I thought I had come to. The map was a real map, from a printer's shop, the result of a survey commissioned by some variety of government which claimed sovereignty hereabouts. My favorite part was a little box in one corner labeled Legend, where the symbolism of the thing, its intent, lay revealed in pictographs. I opened and closed the map so many times in the rain the past 3 days that it was already coming apart at the creases, and I rubbed at the rent places with my finger as if I could mend them back with a magic touch. The land I had already traversed was displayed in fine detail regarding state and county lines, towns and turnpikes and traces, mountains and rivers. But westward, at a point about where I guessed I was, the map turned abruptly white, and all the geographic opinion adventured further were the words Indian Territory, lettered rather big. No fading or tapering off, everything halted all at once. So the lesson the map taught was that knowledge has strict limits, and beyond that verge, the world itself might become equally unspecified and provisional. In my mind, the place thus rendered could be contained within no state and could contain within it no counties or towns. What mountains and rivers the geography held would lack official name and be whatever the few people living there chose to call them day by day. Brown River when you crossed it one time, Green River the next, or just give it your own name, World River. Put your impress on the land and see if you could force it to stay how you had decided to call it. The white landscape ahead was apparently open to considerable suggestion.
So, the exercise I'm going to ask you to do, now that you've heard these passages from 13 Moons, I'm going to ask you to try to choose some object from around the house or work or wherever and practice this exercise. Practice describing it in a way that's very fresh and unusual. And I really want you to push yourselves. Use this 13 Moons as an example. So here are some tips. Try to use all five senses. Think about the object's scale. This tends to be really helpful for me. I think if you imagine what the object would look like from the point of view of something comparable, very large or very small, this kind of comparison method helps us generate metaphors. That happens a lot. So scale is often helpful for me. Remember, you want to invoke a sense of awe in the reader. We're awestruck when we see things in a new light. Another tip, maybe take something apart or write as though you're taking something apart and putting it back together. So again, you're looking at something from a brand new point of view. Enjoy. Do the exercise. Take however much time you need, but I'd like it to be a journal entry, and I'll see those when I collect the journals at the end of this month. Good luck, everyone, and happy writing.